Hello, Agnes.
Hi, Robin.
Today we have a special guest.
That is me.
And who are you?
I'm William Elliott. I've been helping Robin and Agnes with the podcast since the start. We've been slowly improving sound quality and helping with the distribution as well.
And we are very grateful, so grateful that you are visiting with us, and we have decided to let you choose the topic of this podcast.
Yeah, very generously, you've invited me out, and I'm very happy to be here. It's exciting to be in Washington, D.C., which is near where Robin works,
right.
And Agnes is also visiting, so all three of us are in Agnes's Airbnb at the moment.
Well, it's exciting conditional on your existing, but that's going to be the question for us right now.
This is the question of the day. So I'm very interested in this whole concept of existence versus non-existence. I think there's kind of weird biases. The Anthropic one is the most obvious one, of the fact that you exist. But I wonder if there's a way of talking about existence or remarking on whether existence has value outside of the fact that we are experiencers of existence.
Would it help to comment on preferences over existence, which isn't quite the same as value? That is to notice that people have choices about their future existence, at least. So they can choose how long to live. And we might think they are composed of like many parts, like a person at a moment is one of their parts. And they are this combination of all their person moments. And some people choose to have more person moments. And they make trade-offs based on, in some of those person moments, they might think, well, that's a pretty bad one. I guess I wouldn't want that to happen. So like somebody about to suffer a very painful death might choose to make the death happen earlier just to cut off that whole painful part. Right. But somebody who expects a healthy life, they would regret losing, you know, those up dying earlier than they planned. And don't those count as preferences over existence?
They seem to, just in the description that you give right there. I think that given that at every timestamp of existence, we can choose whether to continue existing roughly because suicide is an option that's available to everybody on Earth. And that implies that you therefore are choosing to continue to exist. So this is quite a common thing that if you think existence is probably net negative, then you might say to that person, why not just...
Why keep going?
or the alternative.
Why not stop?
Yeah, why not stop, right? So I think it's easy to say that. There's kind of a weird thing, which is, it's almost like once you're on the boat, it's harder to get off than it is to, it's not as abstract as just a binary decision to continue living or not. At least in my experience personally, it is.
Since we all expect eventually to stop, then people make choices about when to stop.
Yeah.
So stopping sooner or later, and it doesn't that suggest that if they try to stop later, that they want to continue.
Can I respond here? So like I just want to develop Will's thought, which is, it's just very well known that there are these biases, like status quo bias or endowment effect or however you want to call it, where once you have something, you don't want to let it go.
Yeah.
And I think that our attachment to life is like the mega status quo bias. And so, wait, hold on. And so I think that just really often, actually, people will cling to something, even something that is worse for them and that makes them miserable, right? Because they just can't imagine letting it go. And it could be a marriage, it could be a job, it could be sort of like the idea of having, say, an academic job or whatever. And I think it could very well be existence. And so we can't go merely on preferences. And to your point, Robin, that we all know we're going to die eventually, I don't think that's so obvious. That is, it's not so obvious people have accepted that. I think we're in a massive amount of denial about the fact that we're going to die. And we don't really accept it. And we don't allow that thought to enter into our conscious existence. And when it does, we are just filled with blank, mute terror. And so I don't think we can use that to say, well, we know we're going to die eventually. We just want it to happen later rather than sooner. I think it's, in fact, we're in denial about it. And we cling in a not rational way to the thing we've always had. And none of that is an obvious indication that it's better.
I think people throw around these bias arguments way too freely. author of a blog called Overcoming Bias, there are many, you know, psychological review articles that suggest that this endowment effect goes both ways and that there isn't an average effect one way or the other. So in some cases, people may be overly attached. Other cases, they're underly attached. I also don't think it's obvious that people are in terror, therefore suggest they don't really know if they don't want to die. The most obvious interpretation is they are in terror of dying, suggests they don't want to die. Isn't that just the most obvious, straightforward interpretation?
Can I read you something that from, I've read you this before, Raman, but I'm really happy that I get to read it to you again. This is from an essay by Schopenhauer that's called On the Doctrine of the Suffering of the World. And so I'm just going to read two quotes. First, if suffering is not the first and immediate object of our life, then our existence is the most inexpedient and inappropriate thing in the world. Okay, that's the first one. And the second quote is, whoever wants to test the assertion that pleasure in the world outweighs the pain, or at any rate that the two balance each other, should compare the feelings of an animal that is devouring another with those of that other. So Schopenhauer thinks it's just an obvious, self-evident fact that life is on balance incredibly painful. Life for human beings, for animals, is just filled with pain and suffering and, you know, occasional tiny amounts of pleasure. But the dominant experience of existence is one of pain and suffering. That's his view.
Yeah, I mean, going off of this, there is this problem. I know you say you're reluctant to call it a bias, but I think this is kind of like a game theory situation where you're in the game, and by being in the game, as in you're existing, you do have this sense that it's not a decision that someone outside of the game is making. It's someone inside of the game, and that I think is subject to the biases. Such the ones that Agnes was talking about, the status quo bias and so on and so forth. Because it's not as if we're talking about a question of, I'm God, do I create William or not? We're talking about, okay, William's been created, does he continue existing or not? So I guess before the life is created, should it be made or not? That's kind of question one we have here. And then there's question two here, which relates to the Schopenhauer quote and this general kind of utilitarianism arguments is, should you end life prematurely, or how should you deal with the fact that there is suffering in the world? What's the best quote-unquote solution?
Right. And, you know, with respect to the... sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. Robin, go ahead.
Well, so the relative fraction of suffering and pleasure is just not directly relevant to the question we're talking about. The question is, do you want to keep going?
Is it worth living?
Right. Yeah. And you could want to keep going even if your life is full of pain. That's a completely coherent stance, because it's the alternative isn't pleasure. In this case, it's not existing at all. And you could just want to keep going. And I still would say the vast majority of people seem to want to keep going. That is, in most situations, that's what they choose. Seems like the straightforward interpretation is that they would rather have more existence.
Oh, I remember what I wanted to say. One way to test the idea of, like, suppose you were God, right, would be, instead of looking at whether people want to continue their lives, where they're likely to, I do think are likely to be subject to this bias. It's similar to, do they continue romantic, go off and continue romantic relationships that make them miserable, right? They just can't imagine getting out of it.
And they break up too soon too.
You can measure it as how much are people choosing to create life, right?
Yeah.
And like, are people choosing to have kids or not? And so you might think, if people choose to have less and less kids, that's just a sign that people value life less than they used to, say, when they have more kids. That would be one way to measure. Not like that'd be better, because you're talking about the like existence that you don't that you're not already implicated in.
So there's two questions that are closely related. One is, do you want to keep going? And the second is, do you want to create more life?
Exactly.
That is, do you want to have fertility? Do you want to have children, basically? They're related in the sense they're both choices to create more existence. But one choice is much closer to you in the sense that you're continuing you, say, right now. and you have a much better sense of what that life would be like.
But you're also got the bias in the one case and
the
other.
You haven't established that this bias exists. You just have claimed that bias exists.
Okay,
I'm
but
not
I
actually see the evidence for it.
I think that we have to remember that there's I don't know if there's a word for this, but it's like a biological bias, which is evolution's primed us to quote unquote keep going. But
that doesn't make it a bias.
It does if we're thinking about a philosophical plane where we're just determining whether existence is a good thing. We're trying to.
But why think of evolution's attitude as presumptively wrong? Right? Why not think evolution thinks you should exist, and that's a good reason to think you should exist?
Because I don't know. Because I personally don't go to evolution for guidance on what my morality is.
Why not?
This is another argument.
So this is kind of the underlying. This is the seed inside the apple. Maybe is does evolution provide morals? And can we use the fact that it's constantly driving for survival as proof that survival is a good thing, regardless of, say, pain and pleasure? And I'm undecided. You know, I'm not a philosophy student.
I would say evolution is a good guide for you to guess all aspects of your mind that you aren't directly able to inspect. That is, evolution designed this mind of yours. It's a big, complicated object, and you can't see all the parts of it, but you could use evolution to draw inferences about what's likely to be in the parts you can't see. And yes, evolution has likely designed your mind to make you want to survive and persist. Therefore, you probably want to survive and persist, exactly because evolution probably put that there.
And you don't think that's a bias?
No.
Why is that any different to, say, status quo bias?
Pause for a moment. I didn't accept there was a status quo bias, if you recall.
Oh, I see.
Sometimes there's a status quo. I mean, sometimes people are biased in that direction, sometimes in the other. The literature, I do not think, gives an overall bias.
So can I give an example? Suppose there's a kind of animal. Let's say it's a koala. Mm-hmm. It's like cute. And that animal is sort of, if left to its own devices in its natural environment, is going to go extinct, which we could represent in Robin's terminology as evolution wants the animal to go extinct, right? It has competitors, whatever. Now, according to you, the moral thing to do then is to let it go extinct because we are following through on evolution's intentions?
That wasn't the structure of my argument.
But seems like that is the parallel to your own case. Like, evolution wants me to keep living, so I should. Evolution wants the koala to die.
No. So, I mean, part of your question is, what do I want? Mm-hmm. Okay. And what you want is in part indicated by all the choices you've ever made.
Yep.
Those are indications of what you want. Part of what you want is also indicated in part by the thoughts in your head that occur when you imagine making a choice one way or another. Is it terror or joy?
Yep.
But another thing that is a predictor of what you want is the process that produced you, which is evolution. So the koala, we would expect evolution to produce the koala to try to survive. That would be our prediction about koalas. We do not predict that if a species is going extinct, that evolution has encoded in that species the desire to go extinct. That's just not plausible evolutionary story.
Right, but it's like encoded in the other species, the desire to take up the niche. That
right, so if we were trying to predict the koala competitors' minds, then that's what we would predict about those minds.
But we could also predict about the whole, like that whole part of the world.
But the challenge here was to predict what one person wants, like Will, and I'd say evolution is a guidance to help us predict what does Will want in the cases where Will can't just look directly and know what he wants.
It just seems to me that there are so many occasions where what we want is not paralleled with evolution. So to say that evolution is going to tell us what we want with regards to our own existence.
Well, again, I gave you a bunch of different things, all of which are indicators. So you're going to try to combine all the weak indicators you can to make your best guess about what you want. But it's one of the indicators. It's certainly, you know, it's correlated positively. It's not correlated perfectly.
Sure. Okay, so can I ask you, I think I can put it in the answer, but why do you think that evolution does provide a good guide for what decisions to make?
The idea would be you want something. That's the key concept we're trying to infer. That is, you're about to make a choice, and one of the choices somehow corresponds better to what you want. And you've made many choices in the past, so it's the same concept, basically, reapplied in a new context. Like, you made a choice before about what you wanted. Now, all the times you make choices, you make it in a noisy environment where there's a lot that can go wrong, so you don't perfectly choose well, right? Mm-hmm. So one of our explanations for your choices is noise. We expect noise goes into your choices, but we're trying to disentangle what you really want from all the other noise. And so again, you are a machine created by evolution, a complicated one. And if we can understand the design priorities that went into constructing you, that can give us a hint about the kind of decisions you were designed to make, and therefore about the kind of things you would want. And that's one useful source of information about what you would want. In addition to, again, the previous choices you made, the choices of other people who are like you, the feelings you get in your head as you think about making the choice, right? Those are all clues about what you want. And you want to combine all the clues you can to make your best guess about what you want.
I think I understand why you're not scared about the AIs, like the singularity, whatever, AI becoming conscious. Because if the AI were to reason in the way that you just reasoned,
exactly,
then it would just do what we want. But the reason people are scared,
just do it.
The reason people are scared is they think, well, the AI is going to start thinking for itself. And that's what all of us are doing. We're thinking for ourselves. We're like, I don't care what I was designed to do. I now own myself, and I now am able to reorient myself towards the good in my own.
You could say those words, but you are, in fact, still executing the program that evolution built inside of you.
I mean, I'm going to do that no matter what. I don't have to worry about what evolution wanted. It'll just work.
Right. But you might say, want to produce choices that you won't regret later. And evolution can be a guide to what you won't regret, because evolution produced your regret.
Sex produces many regrets.
Yeah.
And that's what evolution designed us to do. So it doesn't seem true that following evolution doesn't lead to regret.
Here's a whole different way to think about the subject. So often in society, we think about all of us together trying to sort of have shared responsibilities. That is, if we have this shared infrastructure of, say, a government and electricity or whatever, then we should each do our part to make it continue and support it, right? That we have some social responsibility to allow society to continue, right? And that's a responsibility a bit above, you know, just what you want. You should help society continue and exist. Now, you know, that it's not an overwhelming consideration, right? If you have enough consideration, for some reason you need to crash your car into a power station, and that'll deprive us all for power or something, right? You know, we want you not to do that. You have a bit of a responsibility to avoid that, but not an overwhelming one, right? Well, think of then all the generations in sequence that go all the way through time, right? You know, the ball gets handed generation past generation, and if you drop the ball, all the generations after you, you know, lose. You're part of this collective effort where, you know, you shouldn't fail everybody else.
Let the team down.
Like, so there are these interesting pictures, like sometimes like somebody will be out drowning in the ocean and they'll make a human chain of people with somebody on the shore holding onto something. And one by one, they're all holding on to each other till they stretch out to the person in the ocean and grab their hand and can pull them in, right? And if you've joined this human chain, you have a bit of a responsibility not to let go of the people next to you. Not only might you be in trouble, but like the whole rest of the people out toward the ocean, they might get swept out. And I would say you have a bit of a responsibility as the result of all the generations that came before you, all of whom continue to exist and pass the ball on. You should.
Well, you should have kids, but you can commit suicide after that.
Okay.
Then you've done your part.
but that part of it is still, I would say you have a bit of a responsibility there.
Okay, so I have doubts on this as well. I just don't know that a life that isn't going to exist were you not to have a child has any value, moral value to you today. Because no one is affected by it not existing except for the rest of society, which may have required its presence, that child's presence.
I think you're comparing two states of the world. One state where the creatures exist and another state where they don't. You're anchoring on the state where they don't and saying, that other state's hypothetical, I can ignore it. Mm-hmm. I can anchor on the state where they exist and say, your other state is hypothetical, and say, this is the default state. And with respect to this default state, you're killing them.
So if I say that society is going to continue and that these humans will exist, then I think it's moral to act in ways which are going to positively influence their lives. So don't drive into the power station, you know, focus on things which might seem problematic to future existence, such as AGI safety, for example, or, you know, nuclear risk, maybe even something like climate change. I understand focusing on those when you know that those lives are going to exist, but you could also take a different strategy, couldn't you? You could say, no one is to have any more children ever, and we're going to fade out and fizzle away. And I wonder if the latter strategy of fizzling away is more or less positive in terms of moral value than the former of letting life continue. And when we make that decision, we kind of got to forget what's happening right now, because that can change in a matter of, I don't know, 150 years.
How about think of it this way, in terms of cosmology, you know, we're all alone, say, probably for the nearest million galaxies. Mm-hmm. And if you really like the existence of dead stuff with no people with pain, look at all of the other galaxies. There's just this one planet in a million galaxies that has life. Why not just allow that one experiment to continue there? Must everything be dead?
But you don't
think
just
allow one
dead.
Of them? I think there's one per million galaxies, I would say.
Okay.
Yes, there's aliens out there, but they each are alone per million galaxies. And so within the million galaxies of each alien species, almost all of it is dead and empty. And there's just this one tiny piece of life. And you're saying, shouldn't that be dead too? And I'm going, come on, like, let there be some life somewhere. Like, if there's a portfolio benefit here, maybe death's is good, maybe life is good. Let there be a little bit of life.
I think that with respect to the, so I'm sort of with Will in saying that there's something weird about the idea of moral obligations to non-existent people. And like you said, well, Will is anchoring on the case in which they don't exist. But I don't think that, and you want to anchor on the case in which they do exist, but in the case in which they do exist, you can't make them not exist, right, if we're in that. So, like, it seems to me we're neither
it's
assuming
true
that
in the
they,
other case, too.
Right, we're neither assuming that they do or don't exist, right?
That's what I mean by anchoring. We're focusing on one case and comparing the other to it as the reference point.
Right, but I think insofar as we're trying to decide what to do, we actually have to view both of these as live possibilities.
Agreed.
And I think, you know, if there is going to be a rule that says, well, you have to go this way rather than this way, I don't think it can be because you have a moral obligation to those non-existent people. Because I don't think you can have a moral obligation to not yet existing people, even if they're potentially existing. I think you can have an obligation to them conditional on their existence. So supposing we know there will be people in 100 years or in 1,000 years, we have obligations to keep the environment in a certain way, right?
Yep.
But the obligation to the non-existent people who would only exist conditionally on our decision to make them exist, it's just not obvious that we can have an obligation to them to make them exist. It might still be good to make them exist for other reasons than having an obligation to them. We might just have an obligation to make the world as good as possible. That might be the best world. And so we have an obligation to bring it about. But one thing I don't think we have is an obligation to them to bring them about. I don't think that makes any sense. So a utilitarian argument still works, right? Just not a deontic argument. Mm-hmm. You can just think that world, and that's sort of what Robin was saying. Look, the world in which Earth has life in it is a better world than the world in which Earth doesn't. You should bring better things about, so you should make that come about. The question then is just whether that's true. But I don't think you have a duty to... It's not like the human chain case, where the people are already there and they're going to die. So I think that that's a really...
I could say I was always destined to let go of the chain. I'm letting go of the chain now. It was always the way it was going to be. They were always going to drown. Therefore, I have no responsibility.
If it's true that you were always destined, I mean, you could say that and be lying. But suppose it's true. Suppose you couldn't control your arms, right? And that a thing was going to strike you. Well, then, in fact, you're not responsible, right? So I'm saying if we suppose that their deaths actually have nothing to do with any of your choices, which is what you're doing when you're anchoring on the possibility that they exist, then it no longer makes sense to speak about what you're morally obligated to do or not.
I am more of the position you'd be morally obligated to make the good if you can.
Well, right. So the question is, What is the structure of that obligation? Why? There's two possible reasons. One is you have a duty to those people, which is what your holding hands metaphor was getting at. I don't think that works. So I think we got to dump that one.
I disagree.
Well, I have an argument. The argument was that in your example, it's crucial to your
You
example.
Say I can't be obligated to a creature who doesn't exist yet. I disagree.
You can't be obligated to bring about that creature's existence.
Why not?
Because their existence is conditional on that very decision.
That's a coherent obligation. You could say it's wrong, but it's a coherent obligation.
So what I'm saying is you can't argue for the existence of such an obligation on the basis of an example where that example is you letting down people that are holding your hand that already exists.
Any example is motivating. It's not going to be an exact parallel.
Okay, but this is the feature that we think is relevant. So you're not going to persuade us by trading on an ambiguity exactly there.
I would add to the example of history that not only are you the end of a long chain of people who continued your line of your lineage, you're the end of a long chain, many of whom eagerly wanted that lineage to continue. They weren't indifferent to this lineage continuing.
So it's kind of like a historical debt. You're continuing to pay.
Yeah, they created you in part. You owe them. Part of what they want from you is that you continue.
I don't understand why you owe them. That is, you didn't make a deal. There was no contract.
We can owe things without a contract that you made. You can be endowed with contracts.
Suppose that somebody comes to your house, right?
Yeah.
And they renovate your house and they make it look really nice. They sneak in, they're not there, and they renovate it. And they're like, you owe me now. You owe me money for this renovation.
But we're talking about your parents, right? Not a random person that comes to your house. What do you owe your parents?
Your parents are a random person that you never met before you come into existence.
I think you can owe your parents. They are not just some stranger.
Of course they are.
But your parents had you for their sake, not for your sake.
How do you know it's not for your sake?
Because I think most of the times, well, because evolution would say, like, you know, sex is enjoyable. We've now created the child.
Of course parents can do things for their children's sake, part of which is to create the children. I think one of the things parents most do for their children's sake is to create the children.
I mean, suppose your parents came to your house while you weren't there, right? And they renovated your whole house with very, very expensive materials. And your parents say, okay, we did this whole thing. And we're your parents. You owe us money. Do you think you owe them?
I think your parents get a lot of deference when they say, look, kid, we're happy you exist. We're glad you're happy you exist. But there was a deal here.
So do you,
something we wanted out of
do
you.
Do you have kids partly
and-
because... to satisfy your parents?
Perhaps. I wasn't very consciously thinking about that. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about, can your parents have claims on you? Can they say, look, we did this nice thing for you. You should do this nice thing for us.
One sign of whether they can have such claims is, do any of us respond to them? Do you have kids? I certainly didn't have kids to satisfy my parents, and it didn't sound like you did either.
Long ago, there were these people called Hare Krishnas. It was a religious group, and they had this trick of staying in airports and handing people flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the trick was, if somebody gives you something, you accept the gift, and then they ask for something, you feel obligated to give them a return. So they were asking for donations in return for their flowers.
Right. Right?
And this is a common marketing strategy, which is, I do think, reflecting a real actual human norm. Somebody gives you a gift of value and then asks for something from you. You have a bit of an obligation to try to help them out.
You can't refuse the gift because you can't at the point of birth say no thanks.
No. Nevertheless, the norm still applies.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me like you thought it applied in my example of the people sneaking into your house, even when those people were your parents. So in many cases, the norm doesn't apply.
I would say if somebody sneaks into your house and actually does something add value, you could be pissed they didn't ask for your permission, but you should honestly ask, did they add value? And how much are you willing? And how much is that worth to you? And if they actually did something nice for you, then you should acknowledge it and maybe credit them in compensation even. Yes. They did something nice for you.
See, if I took a crazier example. there's a philosopher was it Shauna Schiffer? I think it might be her, who thinks that you wrong your children when you bring them into existence because you didn't ask for their permission to exist. And there might be I think there are, in fact, lots of bounds on why you can't commit suicide. Like, it's being illegal. You might think it's immoral for a variety of reasons, right? You might think you're not allowed to commit suicide. And so you've, like, trapped your kids in existence, and that's an immoral thing to do. And it's, like, wrong to have children for that reason, because you didn't get their permission. So
in our last podcast, you know, we discussed this common observation that consent is actually not that central to our concept of many kinds of social processes. Mm-hmm. Consent is more how we manage our conflicts.
Yeah.
Consent is an important central construct to figuring out how to deal with the fact that we each see value differently and have and achieve different values in things, but that the thing itself, consent isn't that central to it. So I might invoke that observation here and say, look, you know, the fact that you owe your parents doesn't have that much to do with consent. Like, parenting is the kind of process where they really just can't ask you permission. Sorry. They're going to have to make a choice and we'll have to deal with that. I mean, it would be nice if you could ask permission. So actually, as a side comment, you know, I have this book called The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life, and Robots for the Earth, where emulations create other emulations. And for emulations, they can ask permission before they create a new emulation because they're making a copy. And so you can go to someone and say, can we make a copy of you? We'll have this new life over here. Will that be okay? And you could say yes, and then the copy's made, and then they have this life. So for emulations, we can ask them before we create them, would that be okay? So, but that's just not feasible for humans today.
So I totally agree. That would be a really lovely solution to a lot of problems if you could ask your child before it's born, do you want to exist? And the fact that it could be a thing with the ends is a good thing. But I mean, I'm worried about something there, which is that the M isn't making the child M in its unborn state might not be making a decision completely by itself. Like, it might have the same, to come back to what we were talking about earlier, it's like the same, sorry to use the word biases, or the same kind of impacts, the same kind of influences in its decision making, which might not mean it's making an accurate choice. So let's just say briefly for a moment that evolution hasn't made us into philosophers. It has, but let's just say it hasn't briefly. And let's say we were deciding whether to make a brand new planet with a brand new species or not. And let's also say, I think this is right, but I don't know. Does evolution exist without life? I don't know if it does or doesn't. It seems to me it probably does, but it's just kind of one of those like undiscovered laws maybe, that needs life to be.
We might say selection creates life. So selection can't create life unless there was a moment when there was selection without life.
Interesting. I guess what I'm saying is before I'm worried that if we're making decisions about whether existence is good or bad from the point of existence, as in we are existing, if only we could be like the God that's deciding, should I make this planet, this universe, or not make it? And then we wouldn't be going to these arguments like, oh, evolution has decided that there's an imperative to continue existing. Because you choose, if you were God, you would choose evolution. So the fact that we can't choose that doesn't seem like a strong reason why we should continue to follow it. It's something that we haven't chosen. It's something that we've been forced into.
What other basis could you possibly have for figuring out what you want other than what you are? That is, either what you want comes from inside of you or it comes from outside of you. If you're going to reject inside of you, what outside will you point to? Where in the universe will you look to find out what you want? I would say most people think of what you want as found inside you, but inside you was created by evolution. All those intricate structures you might look at and reflect on inside you to figure out what you want, those are all created by evolution.
Yeah, so that's very convincing to me, as in, like, where else am I going to find the answer? Because it's not as if there's non-life forms which are capable. I mean, I don't really know how to think
about this. I mean, the moon is dead. Well, yeah, where on the moon will you find the answer to what you want?
The moon, in the kind of DNA of the moon, there's not going to be the answers to this question. I agree with you. And like, if you thought you'd made some kind of super maxi intelligent AI, which you could ask questions about the kind of source truth of the source code of the universe, even that you would still be maybe subject to these same concerns about evolution, because
the AI would have come from some evolved process.
Exactly.
So
where do you go for this answer?
I mean, imagine human beings trying to ask themselves this question before there was language, okay? And they're like trying to figure out what they want. Obviously, they are not very sophisticated in how they think. And you might have thought like, well, first thing, if you want to figure out like what's going to make you happy, what's going to make your life fulfilled and meaningful, like first thing you're going to have to do is find a way to like interact with the others of your kind in certain ways, right? And as we learn to do that, right, then we also learn to like connect with each other in ways that are deeper than our original pre-linguistic modes of connecting with each other. I mean, and you know, evolution is mostly gets us, I mean, maybe up to that one, but probably not to
no, I would language. Disagree.
Well, this is a question of cultural evolution, but and like, I guess I think that it's not right to say that our understanding of who we are is something like, well, we'll be satisfied by what corresponds to our antecedent programming. Mm. I think that we can become different and we can like learn and discover things that are of real meaning and value that we didn't grasp at the beginning. They're not just the kind of logical upshot of where we started. And I think that, you know, so there's a philosopher named Bernard Williams, and he has this distinction between things that I desire conditional on my existence. Mm-hmm. This is where Rob reminded me when he started about like how you want to have this conversation conditional on your existence. So things that I desire conditional on my existence, and then things that would give me reason to exist, right? And so like conditional on the fact that I'm going to keep existing, I want food so I don't feel the pain of hunger. I want like the room at a reasonable temperature so that I'm not like sweating. But those are not reasons to exist. They're just things I want given that I do exist, right? And then he has a separate thing of like, what could actually give you like reason to exist or make your life worth living? And he calls those things ground projects, right? They're things where there's something important that you're trying to bring about with your life. And it could be parenting. It could be a change in the world. It could be a way that you're related to other people. There's like some source of meaning and value that means you have a reason for existing. And I think most people are looking for that in their lives. They're looking for the thing that would give their life like a reason for existing. And in some sense, up until that point, we're somewhat taking it on faith. And that's actually sort of how I would put it, rather than saying it's status quo bias. We're sort of like, okay, I'm going to keep existing. I'm just going to assume this is going somewhere, right? But we're actually looking and searching. So I don't think that it has to be the case that we have to look to our coding, right, to say, I'll find what I want by looking at what the person made me as. I think it's like, no, there's a process of inquiry that I'm engaged in. And I'm engaged in it probably by talking to other people and by looking into what other people have valued over life and by trying out sources of value. And what I'm searching for in that process are these like ground projects that would give my life meaning. Williams himself thought that you could find those things and they could engage you, but like maybe for 100 or 200 or 300 years. He thought we weren't the sorts of creatures that could handle immortality. We wouldn't find enough ground projects. We'd just get bored of them. So he thought like, you know, you could imagine life extension and having ground projects for a certain amount of time, but not for like maybe more than like 300 years.
So I really want to challenge this picture you painted that evolution sort of created humans up until the moment they started to talk. And then after that, evolution turned off. And ever then, it's been some sort of philosophical conversation.
Yeah, so I really love this distinction between reasons to exist and things that are morally good while you exist, in a sense. But again, this does have the, I feel like this has the weakness that Robin's talking about, which is that all those things that we might describe as ground projects, good things, reasons to exist, were also designed by evolution.
I mean, even more so that this whole process of discussing things with people and thinking about things in your head, evolution set up that process and has been selecting for that process for a long time, not just biological, but cultural evolution. That is, you are the result of biological and cultural evolution honing that whole process of thinking and discussing things and selecting the versions of them that would survive and reproduce. So you should predict that the kind of thoughts you will have and the kind of discussions you will have will in fact be ones that promote reproduction, at least in the ancestral environments. That it's not, there's not just a random relationship or historical relationship. They are directly related in that way.
But then they often don't promote reproduction. So fertility's going down.
But evolution has this really hard task in this complicated world to produce the tendency to reproduce. You shouldn't expect it to do it in every case exactly right. That's way too much to expect of it.
But the complicated world was made by evolution.
Yes.
So it was influenced by,
it wasn't entirely made, but it was greatly influenced by evolution.
Sure. Sorry, I had a point, but again, I've forgotten it.
So you ask, you know, what is the basis? All of these bases that you will use to argue for wanting to exist or what to do conditional in existence or all of these projects you might accept or not accept, all of the machinery that you will use to do all that arguing, discussing, that was all produced by this evolutionary process, which was blind to the consequences. So it's going to be a noisy thing and have a lot of randomness and have a lot of unintended consequences from its point of view. But nevertheless, that's the process that produced you.
But not only evolution, right? You were just saying there are other things, like laws of physics and stuff.
But those are constant and will never change, right? So
evolution is also constant in that sense that it's just the basic structure of it is constant.
But if we want to predict why you would do one thing versus another thing that we can imagine, we need to be imagining counterfactual variations that are possible, right? So if we want to know what we choose, we're trying to imagine choice A versus choice B. So we have to be thinking about distinctions between A and B. So things that are constant between A and B won't be very informative for predicting your choice between A and B or advising your choice between A and B. So if A and B both are consistent with physics, then, you know, that won't help with that choice.
I remember what I was going to say. It's just maybe an interesting remark, which is imagine if actually evolution is ultimately a self-killing thing. In that over time it evolves to create philosophies and then ultimately whatever instantiation of evolution will ultimately decide actually it's better for nothing to exist. And so it kills itself.
So, I mean, a standard observation, it's a bit trite, but I guess there's some truth to it. Basically, the story is most animals don't understand death. Yep. They don't know that death will happen to them. They just know how they do various things. And they... even if they notice a death in front of them, they don't make the connection to themselves in the future, right? And so they are not terrified of death. Humans are these creatures who can think about death. And so the story was, well, there was this big problem. As soon as evolution created human minds that could think about death, like they got obsessed with death, and then that got in the way of those creatures like being productive, etc. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they could see the cosmos and see their insignificant tiny fraction of it, right? So the story is there was this long period of evolution where evolution had to deal with the fact that giving human minds these broad capacities would create all these dysfunctional scenarios where they would get obsessed and think about the wrong stuff. But we are the result of a long period of selection after that. And so we are constructed exactly to avoid those problems. Our minds are able to set aside our fear of death or come to terms with your small part of the cosmos, right? We haven't perfectly maybe done that, but that's what you should expect your mind to be, the sort of mind that can think about these big things, but still get on with doing stuff.
I want to go back to Will's. I feel you haven't fully faced up to Will's question, which was a really great question. Suppose we make the following empirical discovery about it. We don't know everything about evolution, right? We don't know our state of knowledge. I mean, you know, we're still working on it. And there could be big transformations in our knowledge. And we're imagining a hypothetical scenario where we learn that sort of the evolution is like programmed with a death drive, right? And it is designed for us all to go extinct. And this is the way life works throughout the galaxy, is that it's supposed to like go for a little bit and then stop, and it kind of shuts itself off. Maybe it shuts itself off by having people develop nuclear weapons or whatever, but this is part of the evolutionary programming. It's designed to go out in this way. If we were to discover this, would you think, okay, well, this should change everything? We should no longer aim for fertility. We should maybe we should all kill ourselves because that's what evolution wants, and it'll make us really happy because we now know this is our evolutionary programming.
So distinguish two very different hypotheses here, right? One is that evolution will create creatures who try to survive, but nevertheless, some net effect of the whole process will make it all end and die. A second scenario is that evolution would create creatures who want to die, right? That's a much harder to believe scenario. That is, evolution would select for creatures who want to die, and that's how evolution would die. The first scenario is more believable, that as evolution would create creatures who want to survive, and nevertheless, indirectly, as a net effect of everything, it would all die. But under the theory that evolution will create creatures who want to survive, who try to survive, and it will fail, then the prediction is you will also want to try to survive. And therefore, it doesn't predict that you should expect to find inside yourself a desire to die.
But suppose we are in the second case. I don't think it's so crazy and implausible that there is inside of, let's eat human creatures, a certain kind of impulse towards death. Mm. And that, in effect, let's say it's encoded in us, right? This desire to die. But the way it's going to work, the way we'll eventually kill each other, is that the way that we evolve is that that desire to die grows bigger over time as a proportion of our total desires, right? This is part of how the coding works. And so over time, it becomes more and more important to us. And maybe the first way you see that is lowered fertility, right? Those are the beginning of the new humans, the humans who want to die. And so this is how we see the trend, right? And we see that what our future is going to be like, you know, these humans who more and more want to die. Would you say we should reason from that to, well, we don't want to have future, we don't want to have descendants, and we don't, you know, we should commit suicide?
That's just not coherent with what an evolutionary process is, that you're imagining some other process and you're giving it the name evolution. This is just not an evolutionary process.
So maybe let's just agree with
right.
you that this is not consistent with what right. we take but, ourselves so
let's just
to know about
take a religious analog, right? God
yeah.
made my mind, and God gave my desires, and God created this world of life, and then God, for whatever purposes, wanted us all to die, and yep. God encoded in our minds the desire to die.
Yeah.
And that's slowly getting realized, and then we are all about going on the track to die because we are trying to make ourselves die because we have found that that's it. So that's, I'm setting aside evolution,
but
we can work with a hypothetical with a God there, right?
Okay.
And so now what you should predict is you want to die. That's the literal prediction of this theory. Deep inside you, the deepest, most real structures, the most persistent, the most, you know, reliable pattern structures are, in fact, patterns that say that you want to die. That is your deepest desire.
And do you think once you learn this, you should try to die?
It would tell you that if you choose that, you won't regret it so much. It'll be consistent with everything
dead.
Else. You're, yes, but nevertheless, it will be completely consistent with your nature and your desires that you would make this choice. You know, that if you want to recommend someone to make a choice on the basis of do they want it, that's the recommendation here.
Okay, so earlier you were saying that because it's evolution gives us a drive to survive, therefore it's a good thing to survive and we should continue to have
Therefore it's what you want.
Therefore, it's what you want. Therefore, it's what human values might determine is
if you reflected on all the complicated design, you try to come together with a picture of what you want.
Sure.
That is what you want.
So then that must, by just the principle, it must extend so that if evolution wanted us to die, that would
be... Or if God wanted you to die. If the process that made you...
If the process
made you to want to die, if we can predict that, then... we predict that you want to die.
Then we would say that it's like, in the evolution frame of mind, you'd say, okay, this is like a moral decision to die.
So the morality is separate. So maybe it's time to like make this distinction, but I get the most leverage out of what you want. That is, if we just look at all the choices you've ever made and we say in each choice, you tried to choose what you want.
Yeah.
And then you're about to make another choice. And in this choice, the question might be what you want. There's a different question we could ask. Is that the moral choice? And I would make a distinction between what you want and what the moral choice. I think most people do recognize that distinction mm-hmm. because they often face a conflict between what they want and what the moral choice is. And so I think a better way to say it is that we all want to be moral in part. We just also want other things. And so then sometimes there's a conflict between the part of our wants that is to be moral and the other parts of our wants.
Are the parts that wants to be moral, is that also determined by evolution?
Yes.
So in this story, where
in actual fact,
by God,
in the counterfactual, no, in the counterfactual, maybe God put it there, but in actuality, it's
right. But like, in this world where we determine that overall, it's God that put all these wants into you. He also put the moral wants into
you,
and
the things that conflict against them.
Right. So like, how do you determine in the world that we're actually in? Like, say evolution. Put in us some desires to continue to exist and to reproduce, but that leaves open for you the question of what ought we morally to do,
mm-hmm.
And so how do you determine that we morally ought to do what evolution wants us to do?
I didn't determine that.
But I mean, you were giving an argument that it's like, you know, this is the helping hands argument, right?
Right. Well, and that was showing there was a moral component. That wasn't saying that was the only thing.
But I guess there's the other complications, such as like what you feel like in the moment, or, you know, what society might be telling you, those other aspects. So I guess what I'm saying is that evolution is a part of your decision.
But morals are a part of your decision, and yeah. Evolution produced that part and many other parts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not all parts.
It seems kind of faulty to me to be making assessments about how to act in a system using the laws which brought you about in the first place. Like, there's some kind of faulty
what else
paradox
is there? Is the rejoinder like, what other possible basis could there actually be?
So I'd like to believe that there's something kind of like gravity or some other law, like the speed of light, etc. That is like the whether life should exist or not.
Well, we can have those laws as the causes of these ones that evolution give you. So for example, one standard account of morals is that they're ways to manage the peace in large social groups. That is, what we do is we agree on some morals and we watch for people violating the moral rules, and then we get indignant if they violate them, and that energizes us to punish them for the violations, and that manages, you know, keeps the group cooperative in certain ways. That's a standard story for what morals are, where they came from, why they have the features they do. Under that theory, you'll have similar morals in a wide range of social creatures. It wouldn't just be humans happen to have one particular set of morals. You would expect to see similar morals in a very wide range of alien and other creatures if they function in that same way to keep the peace in a social group. So that would be a way in which they are like the speed of light, right? But the causal chain is then, you know, the universe, you know, cooperation is useful in the universe. Evolution needed you to cooperate, so evolution gave you the morals that produce cooperation, and then that's why you feel the moral obligation to be cooperative in certain ways.
So, I mean, I was trying to sketch the alternative method of making decisions that didn't require you to just look into your own wiring and then say, oh, okay, this is what it makes me enjoy or something. And like, I think that, you know, the word for like coming to have a new conception of how things are, that's based not on like studying what would be a satisfying conception, but studying the way things are, is learning, right? And so you might think, look, value is something that we're still learning. Mm-hmm. Like, as a species, we're learning what's valuable. We don't have a complete understanding of it, and we make mistakes. And so we've done things that are bad, objectively bad, wrong. And we try to correct and we try to improve. And just like we're learning about physics or learning about math, and it's not just learning about our brains, it's learning about the structure of the world, the way the world really is. There's learning we have to do about value. And we do that learning by talking to one another, by building institutions, etc. And those values are not just like, you know, the things that evolution, the constraints that evolution programmed into us to get along. They're in fact, I mean, that may also be true about them. I don't want to deny that. Because of course, physics and math and whatever, those results are also, in some sense, our brain were programmed to have those thoughts. Sure, right? But that's just like to say that our programming is consistent with our coming to know the way things are. And we don't do math by trying to do evolution and figuring out which mathematical result did evolution program me to have. And I don't think we should do morality that way either. That is, I think that the way we do moral inquiry is by trying to figure out what the right answer is, which is the way we do mathematical inquiry too. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of inquiry is possible.
So it's possible that different creatures want different things. It's also possible that along some dimensions, they all want the same thing. For the kinds of things they would all want the same thing of, then it makes sense to inquire about that same thing together in a universal way, because everybody will learn the same thing because it's all the same. if different creatures have different things they want, then it's not enough to know something generic. You have to know about you.
I think you can make the same point about believing. Like, different creatures believe different things, and you have to know specifics about that creature to figure out what it's going to believe. If the creatures are all trying to learn math, or they're all trying to understand physics, then they're supposed to converge, irrespective of if one of them has green tentacles and the other one looks like us.
So that's exactly, in fact, in decision theory, the distinction between fact and values. Facts are about things outside yourself, and values are about you. And we combine them together in expected utility to make choices. So, yes, we usually conceive of facts as things that are just true out in the world. Now, your belief about facts in standard story will depend not just about the world, it will depend on the information you have and your priors. And so we understand how individual beliefs could vary based on individual differences in information and priors. But, of course, we also see them as converging with more information to the fact that they are about. I wanted to make the observation that if somehow you could defy your evolutionary heritage, which no doubt you can in individual cases, and just make a choice about what you value. And so maybe you don't discover what you value, but you somehow choose in a way that reaffirms and reinforces such that you become different than you were. Mm-hmm. And say, you know, you say choose to like pistachio. And evolution only gave you this potential to like pistachio, but over time, as you keep doing something that reaffirms your taste for pistachio, you become someone who likes pistachio more, right? Mm-hmm. And you could say that's a way in which you can defy evolution, right? Evolution just gave you a general potential of a wide range of things, but you made a choice in your life and you became someone who had this value, right? So we could say literally that's a way in which evolution isn't the only determinant of the values you have at the end of this process. Even in that sort of situation, however, in a large world of creatures like you, evolution continues. And the next generation or generation after that is much better predicted by, say, evolution than your taste for pistachio, in the sense that evolution already encompasses the knowledge that different people can play this game of changing their values. And that's what evolution was taking into account when it varied things to try to get the outcome. And that's all part of the game and all anticipated.
Okay, but how's that relevant to my choice? I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, look, evolution doesn't need me, right? So I can't, and then I'm kind of at liberty. And then I might as well just think about what is actually good, since it's going to do its thing.
Within a modest degree of freedom. That's the
but. I mean, I only have this one life. That's my degree of freedom. But, you know, and like I can have faith that evolution's going to do its job with me playing some small part in that. And then I should just figure out what's good and not worry too much about evolution.
But in fact, if you think about evolution, it might help you get there faster because it might tell you.
Help me get where faster? Where evolution wants?
To this pistachio thing, right? You might realize if you looked at evolution, oh, it's going to make me want to do pistachio.
Kind of like a spin-off of the pistachio idea. I was thinking about kind of contradictions within what evolution wants. Let's say we knew kind of in advance that humans were going to be killed by like a fleet of giant squids, and they're gonna evolve to rise out of the ocean and kill us. How would humans react? Well, humans would, if we knew about this, we'd usually develop, you know, anti-giant squid weaponry, and then kind of based off this pistachio example, I was just like thinking, actually, whatever humans choose to do, whatever they choose to do, is because evolution ultimately effectively selected for them to be able to do that, or to do that in the first place. So it's kind of like a slightly inescapable thing, constantly afflicting us.
Up to a point, that is. So there are many games in game theory, as you know, where the optimal strategy is to flip a coin.
Yep.
That is, the equilibrium says flip a coin. Now, the equilibrium doesn't say whether the coin comes up head or tails, right? So in some sense, you are the captain of your ship, the author of your life. You flip the coin, and you decided if it was head or tail. Right. So in some sense, evolution could have constructed you with some randomness. I mean, no doubt it had to take into account there were just going to be randomness it couldn't control. And so its overall strategy for you includes the fact that it can't predict a bunch of details about what you will do. And then you know, that's sort of a story about free will in some sense.
Yeah.
That free will, you know, what seems to you free will is the randomness that you know, the system that designed you couldn't anticipate that it just had to accept.
Yeah, evolution definitely has this like deterministic flavor where whatever happens will be because, in a sense, evolution willed it. Like, so even if you think I'm gonna do activities which were
defined,
I'm saying like the ones which were defined by evolution, they were still defined underneath.
Oh yeah, I meant defy.
Oh, defy. Yeah. Sorry, right. Defy. Yeah, they were still defined by evolution. Yeah, underneath. Yeah. It's kind of a weird, it's not the question of like free will determinism, right. But it's kind of like a weird abstract version which still encapsulates it.
So you can think of a boss with a bunch of employees, and the boss gives certain orders to the employees, knowing full well 80% of people will follow the orders and 20% will be pissed off and do the opposite. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the boss expects. And he chose his orders with that fact in mind.
So like, suppose that you were trying to, you know, decide whether or not to have a kid, right? And you might think that, you know, people should have, I know you're pro-natalist person, so you think people should have kids, right? But presumably you don't think that everyone in every situation should have kids, right? And so right? Let's take the following situation. You know about your kid, that for their entire life, from birth to death, they will be subject to a tyrannical master. And they will, it'll be like this boss. I mean, they basically will just have to do, they will never have a moment of free choice in their lives. They will just have to do whatever this boss tells them. And sometimes it will bring them very great suffering. And sometimes they'll think they're defying the boss, but actually, like, the boss controls them so well that that's just what their boss wanted, right? You might think, should I create this child? And like, in that, understood in that way, and it's like far from clear to me that the answer to that question is yes, but that's the situation you think we're all in.
Because the boss somehow deserves
yeah, exactly.
This, which seems like a weird aspect.
To this weird boss.
The tyrannical
master.
It's
not our parents, because our parents didn't choose to create us, right? Evolution made our parents create us. It's evolution, our evil demon of a god.
Exactly.
That we think we're all enslaved to, and we have to do its will.
So do you guys remember when we started?
Oh, I don't. No.
Okay, so let's wrap up here.
You have a final word.
So I will again pull your mind back to the image, which is factually correct, that for the nearest million galaxies, it's all dead and empty.
Yeah.
Completely dead and empty, except on this one planet where there is this...
A lot of slavery going on.
One species...
A lot of astronomical suffering.
One species which has a lot of suffering, but also a lot of joy and insight and community. And the question is, should this one planet, this one species, this one set of settings, should this be also like the rest of the dead universe? Should we empty it out and kill it there so that everything can be uniformly dead? Or should there be at least one, maybe a million planets?
We'll be expanding.
Where it's not like that. Now, when the universe is half full of life and half full of dead, then talk to me about maybe we should save some dead stuff and not fill it all with life. But at the moment, it seems to me, if you have at all any uncertainty here, give a bit more to the life because it's way unbalanced.
Okay, I feel like we can stop.
Yeah. Before it descends.
Yeah. So I click, I'll stop on the recorder, right? Here?